In a certain sense, this kind of thing is very much like the meetings that were held in the early church, although I'm not trying to get back to that. I'm not sure we'd be very disappointed if we did. If you could be flashed back to the early church, you might wish you were flashed up to the later church. I think this sort of a free-floating situation is more in keeping with the spirit of relatedness to Christ than the pontificating. You know, I could stand up here and pontificate, you see. It means come out with decrees and decretals. I think it's a family. I keep more and more sensing the family thing here, and my task is to share things with you. I'm not here to keep you theologically up in a harness or anything. I don't want to make theologians out of you. I don't think the people that are theologians have been made theologians, actually. I mean, you've been through all the schooling and you know all that goes on in theological schools and all the hassling and all the debate and the rest of it. You're glad to just sort of abandon it and say, let's talk about Christ and talk about our life. Our attempt is to extract from these books of the Bible or these letters pragmatic ideas or instruction that are vital and viable to our relationship to Christ, whereas the approach to books of the Bible is so often systematized. The first thing they want to get is an outline. And I'm not sure Paul ever wanted anybody to outline his letters. I'm not sure you'd want somebody to outline your letters. When was the last letter you wrote? Would you want somebody to take it and try to make an outline out of it? Much less define the words. Well, I think we break the mold of being religious and formalistic, which tends to obscure the vitality of it. You can get a lot of theological ideas, and yet the vitality of the message is obscured by the regimentation. I go into a lot of things here that would not be part of your formalistic sermon. I wouldn't be a good sermonizer. I gave up sermonizing 30, 40 years ago. All sermons do is give you opportunity to think about what you're going to have for dinner. What do we make today? Let's see, beef. Oh yeah, that's what's for dinner. That kind of flexibility and casualness does not go over well in all circles. I don't sound too authoritative, I guess. Don't stand up and pontificate. I hope you understand that when I give you the travel issues, the things that happen on the trips, that strictly for the reason of showing the practicality of Christ working with us, guiding us, apart from ourselves. That's the important thing. I always make it clear to you that it's as viable to you as it is to me, because it's very important to me to pull Christ into the daily stream of our lives, where we know he's around, not because he does great miracles so much, but because he moves in our lives to put us here and there. And occasionally we get some confirmation of that. But I have to have confirmation of it rather regularly, since I'm charged with the responsibility of sharing Christ with you, of being a representative of Christ. I don't dare not represent him fairly or truly. I can never say that one Sunday the Lord was with me and one Sunday he wasn't. You know, it's because it may not come over as great, or may come over as repetitious, or it may come over as rather earthy. But it's not the case. You see, as I've often said, the big problem here, in fact, it's true in any meeting, but more especially when you're communicating the truth, is that everybody has a different brain grid, you know. I have to to speak the language of however many people are in the room, 50, 30, 100, whatever, there are that many different brains in the room with different grid patterns and different needs, and who have different responses to, shall I say, catchwords. That is to say, a phrase will come through and touch a spot in your grid pattern and make sense to you and be helpful to you. It won't touch in the same way another person. The spirit has to say many different things and go down many different roads in order to touch everybody with something. So if I would sit down and plan out a speech, you know, if I were like preparing or presenting a paper to a scholarly society, you organize everything and you work it out in a very formalistic way. If I were to sit down and try to do that from a pragmatic base to figure how I am going to communicate to 30, 40, 50 different people, I couldn't do it. There's no way you could do that. To organize a message so that you know it's going to reach that many different people. But the Lord seems to have ways of picking out these phrases. That's the way I look at it. If I get off on a tangent, it may be one phrase in that tangent will stick with someone and make a lot of difference. But where is the Lord going to pick up that phrase for you? Well, not that I think every word I say is infallible. I know that would be wrong, or that I'd say the message is a vehicle for touching the lives of everyone with something that is instructive or comforting or whatever. If I were out trying to look good, I'd do things a lot differently. But it takes sometimes the jolts and the bumps and the storms and the torments and so forth to fashion the instrument to come across the way it has to touch your lives. Now, I'm developing a little bit this whole theme of who am I and what we are to God. I'm not intending to just make a long series out of that. And I want to get into Ephesians again because it's been a long time since we did it. And again, I'm not going to go over every verse, but I do want to get into Ephesians. Nevertheless, I want to impress on your minds the answer to the fundamental question of who am I? You ought to know that if you're going to be at peace about your life, about the world, about things around you. Certainly not a peaceful time in the world, and yet there's a lot of peace in the world. It's really not a peaceful time in Europe, and yet there's no war in Europe. So why is it not a peace in Europe? Because there are all these fighting factions in there, and the so-called 7 G's, G7 it's called. It's called G7 because there are seven nations or entities all starting with G. So they call them the G7. But they're going through the problem, trying to put it together some kind of an economic base, but they've got a big problem. They're really starting where we were 200 years ago, a little more now. After we finally declared and won our independence, and then after we were cut free of England, of course, the Tories in those days, in the early founding of our country, the Tories were the English supporters who thought we ought to stay with England. And they were regarded as traitorous by many people. The Tory was looked down upon, and yet their whole attitude was, if we cut ourselves loose from England, we've lost our fundamental basis of existence. You know, our economy is tied to England so tightly, and our laws and everything else, so they didn't want to cut free, which would be the same mood of a young person at home who might like independence, but decides, a rarity if I may say so, that they're not really ready to leave yet. I haven't seen that much. They always think the time that they're 18, they know everything and they can support themselves, so ought to go. But it was like that here, that they just didn't want to leave home in a way. The revolutionary group were certain that we could, quote, we can do it. When we finally won our independence, we ran into a host of economic problems. And I have to think the Lord must have had his hand in putting us back together again, because, well, Europe said we can't do business with you, because how can you do business with a freak with 13 heads and 13 states and colonies in those days? England was, and Europe had trouble dealing with us at all. And we had a very severe currency problem. This also has a bearing on all the things I'm going to say, but money in one state was not good in another state. You had the continental bills. You've heard today that it's not worth a continental. Well, a continental was a federal currency after the establishing of the Congress that was supposed to be good everywhere, but it wasn't. So you could have a whole stack of Confederate money which was totally without value to you. And there were trade barriers between the states. It was a real mess, and it was really questionable whether we were going to make it or not. So the Tories, who wanted to stay with England, were in the beginning, of course, looked down upon as not really for the American dream. But after it was all over, it looked like maybe they should have stayed put and stayed the way they were with England. Their hindsight was better than their foresight. Now you look at Europe, you see, and you see the same situation evolving there. Sure, they're all pressing democracy and freedom and so forth, and they've come out from under the communist rule, but they're loose cannons rocking around Europe. And all of this is to say there is no real peace over there in terms of an integrated economy and so on, and there's liable to be trouble for a long time to come, and we're liable to have to step in and give them some help, which will make us scream, I guess. It's like after World War II when the Marshall Plan was instituted, which put Europe back on its feet economically, and people were opposed to that, but that brought some stability there to Europe that was very important. The fundamental point here is that there is no real peace in Europe, even though there's cessation of hostilities. You can define peace as the cessation of hostility, or you can define it as the harmonization of society or of situations. And the peace is there in terms of cessation of hostility, but there are an awful lot of problems over there. And the world is still reeling and rocking, even though there is no, or there's very little. Of course, there's a Serbian conflict and so forth, but very little war around the world. It was like the period of time between, at the turn of the century, where you had what was regarded as a development of peace that was going to bring in the millennium. A lot of fairly well-respected Bible teachers thought that there was no war around there. The last war had been 1899, which was the Spanish-American War. But after that, there was a period of time when there was no war anywhere. But people didn't understand what was building in Europe. They just saw the surface of things. Of course, we had a great battle of isolationism where everybody didn't want us to get involved in Europe, but we were really not able to keep out of it ultimately. But the point I'm making is there was a period of peace there where people thought, well, at last we've learned how to live together. And the post-millennialists, in its theological terms, thought that the millennium had come, and would ultimately usher in the coming of Christ. Things would just get better and better and better, and finally Christ would come and be the capstone of the whole situation. And you had a lot of liberals in the camp of all the Bardians and so forth, who were of the mind that God was in all of us and so forth and so forth. Well, then, after World War I hit, Karl Barth, who was sort of a leader, I don't want to get too far off theology, the leader of the liberal movement, all of a sudden swung around 180 degrees and now decided that God was wholly other, and the fact that we were people and not dogs was incidental. But the fortunes of the church and of the nation all went hand in hand. Now, what does all this mean to you, you may ask, legitimately? It means that the world that we are living in is a world rocked with torments, with all the special interest groups marching and shouting and screaming and so forth. It's anybody's game out there. But what are we as Christians doing, or what are we going to do, or what is our position in this world? That's why you have to ask this question. Even though it may seem to you like a history lesson you don't want to follow, but I want us to understand that the cessation of hostilities in the war, with only a few brush fires here and there, does not give us a whole lot of security. Now, we are, on the other hand, you can remember that we are these little ionized particles out there in space, and you have to ask, what do we know about anything? Some people are very rabid about the election. Now, I have to be the pastor of the Democrats and the Republicans, but we have been fundamentally given the place on the earth, vines and branches, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and potter and clay, were vessels being molded by the potter. That's an analogy we can take to ourselves, because it's repeated in the New Testament, the idea of being molded and shaped by God. Whatever you are, a vase to hold flowers in, or something to draw water with, or whatever, is what you are. Then we have the sheep and the shepherd thing, which is that we are a bunch of dumb sheep. Now, you may not like that appellation, but what are going to sheep do? When you pass a pasture, you don't find the sheep out there pulling, not even pulling kiddies' carts. You might find goats doing that. I never saw a sheep pulling a cart, did you? They just sit there and go fat. Now, you don't want to go fat, but I mean, they just eat the grass and grow wool, and they don't do much of anything, and they sleep most of the time, I guess. But you have to look at the analogy. See, when we want to be great souls and do great things for God and be wonderful people, it would be nice to find a nice, sophisticated group that you can get together with. But you can't pick your people. Now, you can go over to some churches, I won't mention any names, and you'll find a more sophisticated group, and they're all relatively successful and affluent and whatever else. And it might be nice to rub elbows or shoulders with the upper crust, the elitists. But you can't do that. In the Lord's view, He has a spot for you, a place that you feel comfortable. That's the only reason I know that it's a spot He has for you, because you can feel comfortable there. If you go to a group of believers who are nevertheless saved, I'll have to say that. I'm not saying we're elitist in the sense that we're the only ones that are saved, and I'm not sure we're the only ones that have any truth. I think we're the ones that fit together, and the Lord sort of brought you here. So if you're here, it's because somehow the Lord has drawn you here. I don't know any of you except the pirates in the front row that anybody took by the ear and dragged them in here. See? But this is something you come to, and the Lord seems to bring you here, and you feel good about it, probably. Unless you say, well, I hate to go there, Lord, but you seem to be driving me there. Well, I hope he didn't have to drive you in here with whips. But the fundamental point of this whole thing is that you are what you are by the hand of God. If you are open to that, see, but if you decide you do not want to be a ewer and you knock off one of your ears so you can pass for something else. I remember the story of Dinky Duck. I gave that some time ago. It was one of our nursery rhymes that our family had. I don't know if any of them, we only have one of them here this morning. You remember Dinky Duck, Lynn? Okay. Now, the story of Dinky Duck was that he saw himself reflected in the waters. I remember the story. She'll have to correct me if I'm wrong. And he didn't like the way he looked. It was sort of the ugly duckling. So he went around trying to find someone to help him do better. So he came across this artist. He said, I'll fix that. I know you don't look very good, but I'll fix that. So he pounded and shaped, and all of a sudden he got through and he says, oh, you look like a bottle to me. Now, if you don't want to be Dinky Duck and you want to look like a bottle, you can let people shape you up. But if you just ask the Lord to do with you whatever he wants to do and to open up the doors that he wants to open and bring you through the mill, when he's using you to fit in with the body of believers. You may not be the kind that will fit in well with some other groups. But anyway, the point is that we've been going over what you are, and what you are is nothing. Now, people talk about that religiously. Oh, I just want to be nothing for Christ. I think I told you the story of the missionary over in China, John R. Mott, actually, but a new recruit came out to the field, and Mott picked him up at the station or wherever he was. And in the course of driving to the mission compound, the young idealist said, oh, I just want to be nothing for Christ. And Mott said, you are nothing. Take it by faith. But the Spirit working in you can fit you into the body where he wants. You can just be at peace about it. Don't go out there trying to be something that you are. In spite of certain churches that try to press that on you. So one thing here, you can be what you are. You can come in t-shirts, and you can come in jeans and cutoffs and whatever else you want to come in. Nobody ever says anything about that. In fact, I think I told you, we used to have a dog that came to church every Sunday. A couple down in Malibu used to bring their dog. That's all they had. They didn't have any children, so they had this dog, and they loved the dog dearly. It was a big dog, like an Afghan or a wolfhound or something. And he used to sit in their convertible, and they would come barreling up here from Malibu. Very sophisticated. Was he a sheepdog? Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you're correct. Yeah, right. So he would come in and lie down in the back of the chairs, never made any fuss, never bothered anybody. Well, anybody can come to this church if they want to. And if anybody gets out of line, I feel like I can straighten them out fairly easily. No, but, if a communist came in, I'd have to... You know, you have to be a minister to the communists as well. They kind of need a lot of help right now. Or socialists or whatever. The point is that the Lord is doing in you whatever it is he wants to do. And you may not always like that. And irrevocably, the point that you may be just a neuron, and yet you are perform an extremely important function that you may not know at all. You're a small part there. So you do what you have to do. The Lord lets some of his people become affluent. I have no problem with that. And some are defluent. Some are divested of their financial stability. And things move along like that. But there's nothing wrong with going to work and getting yourself in a good position. going to school, learning a trade, learning a profession, and following it. That's fine. I'm not saying just to sit on the couch and wait for the Lord to do something with you. But along the way, you have to see that He puts you where you ought to be, here and there, and by one means or another. The Lord will give you grace to handle whatever comes. Remember, I've always said, and I'm going to repeat it, not grace to be nice, but grace that carries you in spite of the fact you may not be nice. You know, people get all out of sorts when things go bad. And they may feel a little negative about Christ. I have known some people even to utter an ungracious word when they were out of sorts with Christ. But His grace, you see, carries you across that. You act as a human. You're not one of the nicey-nice types. They don't last too long here, so most of you can't be that because you lasted a while. But the nicey-nicey types, you know, I guess better not label them. But you know what I'm talking about, the people that are nasty nice. And they always have this smile on their face till they get out of sight, and then they growl at God. But you can come and feel bad if you want to. Listen to the message. You don't even have to sing. Larry doesn't point you out and say, how come you're not singing? There are churches that do that. You've got to come up in front. If you're not singing, you've got to come up and sing a solo. They want everybody to sing. I think it's a big mistake because not everybody can sing. You can come and be whatever you are here. And the Lord has His hand in your life. And you may have a lot of problems, but we all have problems. I have a lot of problems. But I'm like you. I'm plowing through the brush wilderness like yourselves. I still believe this, you know, that the Lord has His hand on my life, and whatever He wants to do with it, that's what He has to do. And I don't have any complaints. It's saying that, why hast thou made me thus? I can't say that. I just have to keep on my collision course, hope it doesn't hit too hard. You know, be at peace is always the bottom line. Don't worry about Europe or who's going to be the next president, because whoever's in there is not going to do much anyway. The Congress will sandbag them one way or another. Just be at peace and put everything in the Lord's hands, and you'll be all right. Well, let me just pray. Father, we ask you to take these words, simple and given through human lips, but we pray that the Spirit will use them to touch the hearts and minds of those that are here. In Christ's name, amen.